What I want to do is a series of things. John Polkinghorne, who we know for many years was a great prophet, has now, for a variety of reasons, written an autobiography, which probably you haven't seen. It's a fascinating read of the life of a very distinguished scientist and Christian. I want to do that. I then want to do an introduction to natural theology from the writing of Alistair McGrath, primarily in his own words, with a little bit of gloss. He's written two books, one on nature, and the second one is basically 5-6 years later, and it's interesting to see what he says he's got to add to that picture. And then at the end of all that, what I'd like to do is to try and highlight what seems to me, out of all the verbiage I've gone on with, 4-5 issues which do raise out of this. After all this, so what? That's what I want to answer the question with. And as is my want, PPS, there are books to read. Alistair McGrath and others. I'll tell you about those at the end. So that's what I propose to do. The sheet is basically what I think the best things in that I'm going to try and say are, but it isn't verbatim by any manner of means. In his autobiography, John Polkinghorne talks in one chapter on his theological writing. And things, I think, which are appropriate and give a little bit of point, I hope, to what I'm wanting to say. He goes on to say, in this book, which is One World, The Interaction of Science and Theology in 86, science and theology are compared, and despite their obviously different subject material, both are held to be concerned with the search for truthful understanding, pursued through the formulation of well-motivated beliefs. These two forms of rational inquiry are shown to be interrelated, though they're giving complementary accounts of cosmic history, which is interpretable both from the perspective of physical sciences and from the perspective of belief in the purposes of a creator. There's no direct entailment between these two approaches, but their insights must bear some sort of consonant relationship to each other. A revised form of natural theology is proposed, not seeking to rival science on its own explanatory ground, but taking the laws of nature that science has to treat as simple given brute fact, and setting them in a more profound context of understanding. Thus, the deep rational transparency of the universe that gives science its opportunity and profound rational beauty of that universe's fundamental structure, which gives scientists the experience of wonder as a reward for their labours, are not just treated as if they were happy accidents. Rather, they are made intelligible by being understood as signs of the divine mind that lies behind the order of the world. The insights of the anthropic principle into the remarkable fine-tuning of the quantitative character of the laws of nature, which was indispensable if the universe was ever to be capable of evolving carbon-based life anywhere within it, can be removed from the category of happy accident by being interpreted as a divine endowment expressive of the Creator's fruitful purpose. That's by way of introduction. So we come to ask ourselves, what is the purpose and place of natural theology, particularly in the writings of Alistair McGrath? Natural theology may be defined as the enterprise of providing support for religious beliefs by starting with premises that neither are nor presuppose any religious belief. And so we need to look at the historical origins of modern natural theology. We must be clear that Christian theologians have always been interested in the natural world, but the term as we now understand it arose as a response to the upheavals in the intellectual world in England during the 17th and 18th centuries. Particularly valuable were the Gifford Lectures, and probably notably those by Charles Raven. They were seen to be more persuasive theologically in their judgments and conclusions. Various developments during that period encouraged a new interest in revelatory capacities of the natural world. These were, firstly, the rise of biblical criticism, which called into question the reliability of Scripture. At this stage, the tradition of the two books was developed, with the Book of Nature receiving greater emphasis as it was more amenable to rational interpretation. There's also a growing impatience with ecclesiastical authority, leading to a desire for independent free thought. There was also a dislike of pomposity of organized religion and a desire for simpler forms of religion. And so this saw the rise of a mechanical worldview. In the 17th and 18th century, it was an important development which would lead to the idea of God as a clockmaker, of which more anon with Paley et al., which could be seen as a natural explanation which leaves God with no part to play. But it did encourage simpler forms of religion. Then there was the quest for a religion of nature. The Enlightenment was not especially anti-religious, but tended to see Christianity as in the dominant role. Some preferred to develop their religion using clues from nature. Robert Boyle was one of the several writers to adopt the metaphor of nature as a temple, with the natural scientist as the priest of nature. And so we come to look at the idea of nature and natural theology and the history of those phrases. Oh, but it's easy. We now see that nature is an observable world. The botanist Linnaeus argued that the patterns of order which he discerned were an important instance of natural theology. Such ordering, he argues, either rested on or otherwise reflected the divine creation of the world. The famed William Paley, 1743-1805, of more whom anon, took the Newtonian image of the world as a mechanism, and it immediately suggested to him the metaphor of a clock or watch, raising the question as who constructed the intricate mechanism. Nature as human rationality was seen as being the doctrine that humanity is created in the image of God, which is widely interpreted to mean that there exists some correspondence between humanity and its creator. Augustine argued that the apex of human nature is in its capacity to reason. It's worth noting that the list of theologies of what the image of God, it was widely believed to mean, could run into dozens. So anyone who says they understand it, you should immediately suspect. And nature as human culture. The appeal to human culture can be argued to lie in the patristic period, and the development of this thought, primarily dated from the 19th century, some liberal theologians regarded human culture in itself as having revelatory potential. This development alone, Karl Barth, saw this approach as fraught with danger and pointed out that culture, like nature, is a social construction which cannot be allowed to become the foundation of a natural theology. Of Karl Barth, more anon. The theology of natural theology, in the Old Testament, there are a large number of appeals to both what we might call natural theology and natural law in the Old Testament. It's within the wisdom literature that we find the greatest number of positive references to the possibility of knowing God on and through a created order. Yet while the Old Testament clearly endorses that something of God may be known through creation, it does not endorse any notion of nature as an autonomous source of knowledge of God. The authors don't offer philosophical proofs to the existence of God. They don't work by means of pure reason. They don't appear to amount to a total system of classical theism or anything like it. In the New Testament, particularly in the address of Paul to the Areopagus, Paul seems to be making the point that God, who is known indirectly through creation, can be known fully in redemption. Elsewhere, Paul accommodated both the substance and the mode of the presentation of the Christian faith to the specific characteristics of respective audiences. The general line of argument is that sufficient of God's nature and requirements have been manifested within the created order to render humanity without excuse for any failure to respond to God. In particular, recognizing their status as creatures. Now, in the 20th century, this consensus has been challenged by Barth, who objected to any autonomous human inquiry into God and the gaining of any knowledge of God on terms other than authorized by God. And so there has been a philosophical debate over natural theology. Several philosophers from within the Reformed tradition have variously contributed to the current debate, particularly Alvin Plantinga. His objection was to a natural theology that supposes that a belief in God must rest upon an evidential basis rather than a basic belief, which is self-evident. He viewed a proper Christian approach is to affirm that belief in God is itself basic and doesn't require justification. He would see this as being the view held by Calvin and the later reformers. This latter point, as I point out, is historically inaccurate. The search for order in nature is therefore not intended to demonstrate that God exists, but to reinforce the plausibility of an existing belief. Looking back at Barth's objections, they've come up again and again. Barth's objections rest on an inadequate biblical foundation and represent a significant departure from the Reformed tradition and reflect an indifferent attitude to the natural sciences. His critique rests on the fundamental belief that it undermines the necessity and the uniqueness of God's self-revelation. Natural theology for Barth represents a deliberate refusal to accept the necessity and consequences of revelation. For him, the quest for autonomy lies at the heart of original sin. As Barth understands the concept, natural theology concerns the human desire to find God on humanity's own terms. How far is this found in the Reformers? A look at John Calvin and Theodore Beza. In dealing with our knowledge of God, Calvin affirms that a general knowledge of God may be discerned through creation, in humanity, in the natural order, and in the historical process itself. Calvin is arguing that anyone, by intelligent and rational reflection upon the created order, should be able to arrive at the idea of God. A natural knowledge of God serves to deprive humanity of any excuse for ignoring him. Nevertheless, it's inadequate as the basis for a fully fledged portrayal of the nature, character, and purposes of God. Calvin does not regard natural theology as offering an autonomous route to a full and saving knowledge of God. Theodore Beza, who lived a little bit later than Calvin, argues that natural knowledge of God may be found both in contemplation of the structure of God, of creation, and from an intuitive human knowledge of divinity. The later Genevan schools, such as Turretini, did go so far as to make such a natural theology the foundation of his theological method. He did allow that it's possible to be saved on the basis of natural knowledge of God. So Barth's polemic against an autonomous discipline of gaining knowledge of God does have familiar resonances with some of the later Geneva school, which shows how the Enlightenment impacted on Reformed theology. But also into the scheme of thinkers who have argued the backs and forwards of this, we turn likewise to Thomas Torrance, the Scottish theologian who, at a ripe old age, is still alive as far as I'm aware. How recently? Not
there. Late last year.
Yeah. A great loss. Yeah. Has written very extensively on natural theology and the sciences. Torrance, among other things, did his PhD with Barth. Argues that Barth can be interpreted to have sanctioned natural theology, provided natural theology is not seen as an independent, autonomous, or attached discipline in its own right, but it is an integral aspect of the overall project of theology. He insists that creation can only be held to reveal God from the standpoint of its creator. Theology and the natural sciences stand together in their mutual affirmation of rationality and intelligibility of the world. The implication of sin for natural theology, in the writing and thought of Gestrick, sin is not to be conceived primarily to accept the limitations and possibility placed upon human existence as a consequence of its creaturely status. If humanity possesses any glory, it's not a glory which is achieved through human achievements, but a glory which is lent to humanity by its creator and redeemer. There are certain aspects of disorder which we see in creation which need to be part of the thought of natural theology. There's no doubt that the Greek patristic tradition, with a firm commitment to the notion of cosmic redemption, saw a correlation between the necessity of cosmic redemption and the actuality of cosmic sin. Sin is naturally understood as the disordering of the cosmos, which required restoration to its original integrity through redemption. The created order, as it presently exists, incorporates within it a deep-rooted dimension of disorder with the potential to skew and confuse our interpretation of its identity and significance. And so, human ability to misread creation, human ability to discern God within the natural order, is arguably it's only arguable at the best of times. What if the already frail capacity of the human mind to discern the creator in the creation were in some sense to be clouded by sin? Such an idea plays an important role in the theology of Augustine and Calvin. Although there is important discussion to be had concerning precisely how Calvin articulates the impact of sin, there is no doubt that he regarded it as having significant implications for human knowing and willing. One of the more interesting features of many recent discussions of sin is that the locus of such discussions has shifted away from the metaphysical or cognitive aspects of sin. And sin these days tends to be primarily interpreted in relational categories. The place of natural theology within a scientific theology varies depending on how one approaches various aspects of Christian theology and natural theology. One view would be that the Christian theology provides an interpretive framework by which nature may be interpreted. Some of the issues have been already explored, and ongoingly in his writings, Alistair McGrath raises other things to put it beside in context. Resonance, not proof. Nature is interpreted irrespective of the nature of the assumptions that shape that interpretation. Natural theology is to be viewed as a legitimate and proper theological exercise to be conducted within the scope of a revealed knowledge of God, rather than an autonomous discipline outside its bounds. The framework offered by Christian theology includes both an account of the natural order as God's creation and of humanity as created in the image of God. On seeing nature as creation, it's wrong to treat the natural theology and revealed theology as being opposed to each other, provided that nature is understood in the Trinitarian manner as the creation of a self-revealing God. But that framework is to be brought in, the interpretive framework which is to be brought into this process involves, one, that the created order is held to be the work of a Christian God, not of any other, whether divine or otherwise. Secondly, the act of creation was not determined or significantly influenced by the quality of the material which was ordered through this act. And three, that the human mind possesses the capacity to recognize this work of creation as such, and to draw at least some reliable conclusions concerning the nature and the character of the God that created them. And we note that many Christian writers have argued that the truth, goodness and beauty of God are disclosed through the created order. And so natural theology is part of the public discussion of nature, and an emphasis on the public accessibility is of the legitimizing resources of the Christian faith is characteristic of the writings of Wolfgang Pannenberg. He is clear that the natural sciences and theology are distinct disciplines with their own understanding of how information is gained and assessed. Nevertheless, both relate to the same publicly observable reality, and therefore they have complementary insights to bring. And so part two talks about certain aspects of this which McGrath brings up as relevant for further consideration. Natural theology is not about discovering persuasive grounds of faith outside the bounds and scope of revelation, but a demonstration that when nature is seen through the lens of Christian revelation, the outcome is imaginatively compelling and rationally persuasive. Now, we then have to deal with a couple of issues which have been plaguing us already. Newman was clearly unhappy about Paley. For Newman, Paley's image of God as a divine watchmaker of the world reduced God to its level. Where was there any sense of transcendence, mystery or glory? Didn't Paley tend to proclaim a somewhat cold, mechanical, distant God, a lawgiver rather than a saviour. More of that anon. Then the challenge of Darwinism. If Darwinism forced anything onto the agenda of natural theology, it was indeed to have a transition from a view of divine creation that held that everything was created in its present fixed form to one that acknowledged the development of some sort had taken place within the natural order. The Darwinian account of natural selection highlights the suffering, destruction and wastefulness of the natural order, filtering out those who are less adapted for survival than their rivals. You may want to argue about the anthropomorphism of that phrase, but still, that's the way that it is viewed. And there have been a number of responses from Christian writers to apologetic challenges faced from Darwinism. One of the more promising is the work of John Hort, who is more distinctively Christian than many of the traditionalist deist or theist apologetic responses of the past. He does raise important questions as to whether a theist or a deist approach to natural theology can be sustained in the changed cultural environment of thought forms in which we live. He wants to raise the thought of incarnation, trinity and natural theology. Hort says, in the light of the theodicy which we see posed by Darwinism, he would include the four following elements, which all are distinctively Christian. One, the notion of a suffering God, which runs counter to a philosophically perceived notion of divinity based on the conception of perfection. Two, the conception of the incarnation, which establishes a link between God and creation, which goes far beyond the act of the original origination and subsequent supervenience. Three, the doctrine of the Trinity, which includes the notion that the Spirit of God indwells the created order. And four, a concept of the economy of salvation, which sets the idea of a creator God in a Trinitarian perspective and emphasises the notion of activity, directionality and purpose within salvation history. Natural theology presupposes the core doctrines of the Christian faith, which impels the theologian to view nature through the lens of the Trinitarian vision of God. Natural theology is the proper outcome of faith, not its foundation, its consequence, not its presupposition. And this, it will be noted, is the last and final and ultimate answer to Barth's worry. A natural theology, in the light of Barth's concerns, can be met by reconceptualizing natural theology as an intellectual undertaking within the community of faith on the basis of its central doctrinal commitments. And then there are the other two matters which also need to be raised: tradition, interpretation and discovery. There is a growing awareness of the importance of culturally inherited assumptions. It's pointed to the early tendency to interpret nature as God's creation ultimately residing in a network of cultural beliefs shaped by the Christian faith of the past. Hansen has constantly emphasised that observation is a theory-laden process, and we bring many preconceptions to the act of observation without really realising we do. Menno's paradox. If one has no concept of God, how can God be elicited from reflection on nature? How can God be discovered when this God is not directly empirically within nature? Alistair McGrath argues philosophically in general, or ethics in particular, can't proceed by reasoning from neutral self-evident presuppositions accepted by all rational purposes. But in working within the tradition that supplies the framework of judgment for those posing those philosophical and moral problems, nature requires interpretation, and that's such interpretations by asked by specific traditions. There's no right, objective or universal way to read nature. The whole of natural theology depends on a tradition-specific interpretation of nature, which sees nature as God's creation. And at the end of all, Alistair McGrath goes back to say, well, cognitive and perceptual approaches to natural theology. There is the need for a fundamental reconnection between experience and understanding. The fundamental theme of any natural theology is an affirmation of an intellectual pathway from the natural to the spiritual, from nature to God. When seen from the perspective of faith, the world indeed is charged with glory and grandeur of God. Natural theology, when properly done, doesn't merely leave us with new academic insights. It forces us to our knees in admiration of the God who has made us spectators in the theatre of the divine glory. Having captured our imaginations with glimpses of glory, not simply persuaded our minds with impressions of rationality. And the five things to say to you, the main issues which seem to me raised, one is the views of the created world with compare Paley and deism, which are in danger of having only a partial attribute of God as the God that they talk about. They portray only some attitudes of God. And there are implications, I suspect, or parallels, which one may find by certain of the emphases of the intelligent design tradition currently around. Two, the Darwinian challenge. The view of nature read in tooth and claw, with all its limitations of anthropomorphism, but the need is for a realistic view of nature, uncluttered by human self-projection. We are learning to believe, to look at nature again as in the process of becoming. And that's, I think, is a specifically Pauline tradition. The Barthian challenge, I think, has been met. It's not an issue if we see natural theology as being carried out within a specific Christian framework. Compare some of our colleagues who work within a specifically anti- or non-Christian philosophical framework. And many of those whom we know ourselves aren't, we wouldn't claim, specifically in principle, bad scientists. Four, the modern answers, such as they are coming now in, from a variety of views, where nature and faith are viewed as having both contributions to make to our view of reality, both equally valid, and both with specific contributions to make. The modern approach to the world needs to include experience and understanding. When a scientist has finished with the world, what has he done to the word love? Expunged it from the vocabulary, I suspect. It's a thing we need to respond to. If we have learned to see the world as God's creation, there is a response of experience to respond with worship and awe, which we are rapidly being mechanized out of. And I would remind you, for obvious reasons, from my own tradition, and Charles Wesley's almost greatest hymn that ends with this marvellous couplet of the future: till we throw our crowns before him, lost in wonder, love and praise. What about natural theology then? I think it's subsumed, I suspect. Thank you.